Hello. This week we'll be looking at how English turned into such a rich and varied language, a language capable of making the following exchange possible.
Mr. Speaker, will you confirm that you actually have the power to order the fat bounder to be dragged from the dinner table?
Order! Well, order! Well, order! First of all, order! I haven't got the power, and I dislike that expression, which I will ask the Honourable Gentleman to withdraw, please.
Well, in that case, corpulent gentleman to actually...
Almost as bad.
Corpulent and right Honourable Gentleman to be brought here in a tumbrel, Mr. Speaker.
The Labour MP, Tony Banks, searching for the right words to describe his parliamentary opponent, Nigel Lawson. If English has a delightful capacity for subtle expressiveness, an ability to say one thing and mean quite another, it also has a capacity for bewildering density. Here is Gordon Brown, the Chancellor of the Exchequer, explaining, well, I'm not sure what he's explaining.
Now, our new economic approach does not simply require us to adapt to changes in the practical world. It is also rooted in changes in the world of economic ideas. The growth of post-neoclassical endogenous growth theory and the symbiotic relationships that people now understand.
As we saw in our first two programs, English has both benefited from and been complicated by its mongrel heritage. Successive waves of linguistic invaders, the Anglo-Saxons, the Vikings, the Norman French, have left us with a multi-layered language that is particularly rich in terms. No one actually knows how many words there are in English. The Oxford English Dictionary contains 615,000 entries, about twice as many as the largest French, German, or Spanish dictionaries. But in fact, if you add in all the terms that don't make it into even an unabridged dictionary like the OED, the proper nouns, the more obscure scientific and mathematical terms, then the number is very much larger, probably not less than 3 or 4 million. Indeed, it can be argued that there are too many words in English. After all, do we really need a word like glabrous when we already have hairless, or sternutation in preference to sneezing, or quotidian for ordinary? The wealth of synonyms and the fractional degrees of difference that sometimes distinguish them can be confusing, as the novelist Marika Kobble discovered when she began learning English as a young girl in Sweden.
I do remember my English teacher at primary school, who was also the headmistress, very early on teaching us the social nuances, and that amused me because I don't think I ever come across that in any other foreign language I learned. You know, that I think it's best, children, if you say lavatory and not toilet, and I think English people really prefer if you say napkin and not serviette. And I remember reacting to that even as a comparatively young child.
And do you not have that sort of thing in Swedish?
Not to that degree, really. I mean, one big difference is that you have more words, it's simply that. You have many more words in English than you have in Swedish. If you look up at a thesaurus here, you'll find maybe 3 or 4 different words that describe the same thing, whereas in Swedish it might only be one. So you have a clumsier vehicle, really, a clumsier tool.
English is so rich indeed that we need all manner of dictionaries to capture it. Medical dictionaries, engineering dictionaries, computer dictionaries, since no one dictionary could possibly convey it all. Jonathan Green has spent much of the last few years picking his way through one of the more interestingly arcane areas of English lexicography, slang. Ironically, he finds it hard to define his own subject.
I find it very difficult to define slang. Etymologically, it actually comes from a Swedish or Scandinavian word which means thrown, same word as gives us sling, and it's thrown language. That is one of the theories. Another is it's the language of criminals because it's the slang which means, slangs actually mean chains, and it's the rattling of the chains, figuratively, symbolically, whatever. But what it really is, it's the language of, it's an alternative to the standard. That's how I see it. It's also a linguistic two fingers or one finger, depending on which country you come from. A gesture of disdain, thumbing the nose to the standard English. It's a release, it's a relief. It's enormously enjoyable. It's a very rich language. It's so difficult. I mean, a word like tanner, meaning sixpence, when we didn't have before decimal coinage. That was slang. Lots of people used it. They probably didn't even know it was slang, but it was. If I look at a word, if I look at a late 16th century, moll whopper pace, I know that's slang. Moll means a scrubber, basically. Wop means to have sexual intercourse, and a pace is standard English meaning fast. So what it means is, you know, she is a girl who, I suppose, has sex quickly. I mean, it's, that's slang. You would not use that in standard English. It is not formal. It is not polite. Slang tends to be impolite, I think. Slang also changes. If you look in 1711, when Jonathan Swift is writing a letter, which I shall paraphrase as something like, for the reform of the English language, he is saying that mob is slang, that bamboozle is slang, that elisions like couldn't and wouldn't are slang, and those in 1711, as far as he was concerned, were slang. But this is a period when, shortly afterwards, Dr. Johnson would define the word illiterate as not knowing Greek and Latin. It is very difficult with language. It tends to be from various people's point of view. I'm amazed that mob should ever have been thought of as slang, but in 1711 it was.
Was slang richer in former times? Was it more productive?
I like the old stuff, but some of the new stuff can be absolutely wonderful. I mean, I think harpic is wonderful. Harpic, which means mad. Why is harpic mad? Harpic is mad because it's clean around the bend.
One of the more indelicate areas of slang, indeed of language generally, is obscenities. But an obscenity today wasn't necessarily an obscenity in the past.
I mean, a very good example, there's a couple of good examples. I mean, one is the word bollocks, which people, I think, would... It's used to mean rubbish in a relatively colloquial way, but on the whole, you know, when you get kicked in the bollocks or whatever it is, that's slang.
Yeah.
The interesting thing is that if you go back to a dictionary or a glossary, to be more precise, a Latin Anglo-Saxon glossary prepared by a man called Abbot Aelfric, which I think around approximately 1,000 years ago, he translates, I think the word is something like testes, as bealukos, which means very obviously bollocks. Once again, there is the word podex, which he translates as, well, he spells it A-R-C-E-H-O-O-L-E, which we know as arsehole. I mean, those words were accepted.
But to find the nerve centre, as it were, of the English language, lexical HQ, so to speak, you must travel to Oxford, to the headquarters of the world's largest and most revered collection of words, the great and noble Oxford English Dictionary. John Simpson, the OED's general editor, took time to show me around.
Well, we're now in the centre of the OED editorial department, which is largely open plan. There are about 80 staff on either side of us. This is an area where there's editors revising the existing text of the dictionary. Moving on over there, there's an area where the bibliographical group are working. Etymology is a bit further along. There's a new word section somewhere as well.
And when will you have this, the revision done?
It'll be completed by 2010, according to the present schedule. So it's a long-term, major international project.
So how many headwords are there in the OED now, and how many do you expect there to be in the revised edition?
Well, there are about a quarter of a million at the moment. I should think probably 350,000, but you'll be dealing with about a million defined terms, I expect. We're now in an area of the OED where people are working on the revision of non-scientific terminology, and Olivia is one of the staff members who's working on particular parts of the alphabet at the moment.
So what exactly are you looking at here, Olivia?
Well, recently I've been working on plant. In this part of the screen, this is where I actually do the editing. In this part, that's how it actually looks. We'll look on the page. These are the tags.
In an atmosphere that seems to owe more to Silicon Valley than to the bookish world of academe, for there are no great piles of papers here, no teetering stacks of musty volumes, only a kind of clinical neatness. In this atmosphere, Olivia Duncan quietly works her way through boxes of note cards, sifting data provided for her by various specialist departments, scientists, etymologists, a news team whose members coordinate a database of citations sent in from readers from around the world. All this is needed to enable Olivia to revise the entry for the word plant.
Here you are. Now, this is an extra sense of plant, which news have added in. So it's to place a bomb in a building, especially as a terrorist act, or to place a kiss. And then that will then get incorporated at the very end into what I've done.
Right, I'm with you.
That's okay.
Incredible.
So it is incredible.
For you,
How long does one range take?
Or actually one word?
One word. It can vary enormously. Very often, long words look as though they're going to give you terrible problems, and they don't always. What causes the problems is if the senses are very close. It can be very hard to distinguish between them. I revised perfect a while back, and that took me a long time, about 10 days.
Really?
Yeah. Because it was long and the senses were difficult to distinguish.
One aspect of English that often troubles people of an orderly bent is that it is forever changing. Words alter meaning over time, often diametrically. Nice, for instance, originally meant stupid or foolish. Then, at various times, it came to mean lascivious or wanton, extravagant, slothful, elegant, slight, precise, and thin. Not until the 18th century did it take on the modern sense of pleasant and agreeable. Most words in English experience some drift in meaning. The technical term is catachresis, to the severe annoyance of those who equate change with decline. It has been this way for a long time, as I learned from David Dennison of Manchester University.
People commonly feel that the English language is going to hell in a way, at a rate that it never has before. Is that true?
Nope. And they've always felt that, you know, nostalgia ain't what it used to be. There is no period of English that we know of when people were interested in the language at all, when there haven't been complaints about change. I think the first real awareness of linguistic issues is around the time of Chaucer. Chaucer writes in manuscripts that he hopes scribes don't miswrite it because there is so much change going on. We go to the 17th, 18th centuries, you know, the attempts to fix the language, to stop it changing, to resist change, to complain about terrible new words like fan and mob and so on. People have always complained about change. I'm not aware that things are any worse now than they used to be.
The way words are used, the grammar and structure of a language, changes too. I asked David Dennison where the notorious stricture about not ending a sentence with a preposition came from.
As far as I know, I think the received wisdom is that it was Dryden, in revising some of his writing, unsure whether he should use constructions like the story of which I have been told, or the story which I have been told of, did what would have been normal in his time, which is to translate it into Latin to see what Latin would do, found that in Latin you didn't normally strand prepositions at the end of a sentence, and decided, well, in case of doubt, go with Latin, went through all his work, doing his best to revise to the new form, and that this particular stricture was taken up by the grammarians of English in the 18th century and elevated into a rule. Whereas, in fact, historically, the form with the preposition late is much older than the form where the preposition comes right at the beginning.
When such change can be seen happening around us, we tend to regard it as a retrograde step. I, for my part, wince at the loss of distinction between imply and infer, uninterested and disinterested, anticipate and expect. Any moderately discerning user of English will have his own list of bugbears.
Well, frankly, the problem as I see it at this moment in time is whether I should just lie down under all this hassle and let them walk all over me, or whether I should just say, okay, I get a message and do myself in.
The question, though, is to what extent we resist change in language and to what extent we accommodate it. John Honey is an educator and the author of a book arguing for a fairly strict adherence to conventions, what is generally known as standard English.
Standard English has been the method of communication amongst people of any kind of education for hundreds of years. If you didn't speak it, if you used non-standard grammar and peppered your conversation with non-standard vocabulary, then people could assume that you hadn't had a high degree of education. That expectation, of course, is now universal. So if people say we was, or them thinks it's nice, we make a judgment about the extent of their education. It's the least educated people who show the most signs of using non-standard grammar, non-standard vocabulary.
Some people, however, believe that standard English is elitist, that it is used as a way of excluding non-standard English speakers from mainstream life. John Honey thinks the opposite is true.
Many linguists have argued for 30 years that one of the bad things about teaching standard English, white, Anglo-Saxon, middle-class speech, is that it is exclusive. It serves to exclude others. Quite wrong, says my book. Standard English is the only one that is not exclusive. All the others are exclusive. You and I can't learn black English. There are no textbooks. There are no linguaphone recordings. Nobody is going to offer to teach us black English. And if we try to speak black English, it will be resented because the outsiders' attempts to speak a non-standard variety are usually regarded as involving some kind of mockery or condescension. So they are the exclusive ones. The Lancashire dialect is exclusive. The Cockney dialect is exclusive. However hard you try, Bill, or I try, we're not going to be able to make it. And our attempts to do so will not earn us the thanks of those people who genuinely speak them from birth. It is the language of birth. It is the language of exclusion, non-standard English. I want to oppose mechanisms of exclusion. It's the language, say the linguists, of working class solidarity, or rather council estate solidarity, or ghetto solidarity. And I say we should be trying in society to move away from the solidarities, the arbitrarily allocated solidarities of the mine, the pit, of the council estate, of the ghetto. We ought to liberate people so that they can operate at any level of society, in any region of society, not trapped by the speech forms which immediately identify them as only coming from there.
What about the argument that, perhaps that's so, but what about the argument that, in other ways they are richer or more expressive, that, for instance, in black street slang, by using double negatives you get an additional emphasis that we can't achieve in standard
English? That's right. Some of them have some riches, as you have mentioned. Glaswegian English, they have wonderful, humorous potential in Glaswegian English. Now, you've got all kinds of humorous potential in standard English, but here you've got an extra dimension if you can add that one. But what it doesn't say is that for 1,000 common objectives of human communication, such as arguing your corner, asserting your rights, gaining respect, getting a job, filling up an application form, for all those purposes, your non-standard dialect is going to be of little avail to you.
In his, shall we say, livelier moments, Professor Honey accuses academics like Loretto Todd of Leeds University of a brand of dangerous liberalism, a willingness to distort and weaken English for the benefit of non-standard speaking minorities. In fact, as I found when I went to visit Dr. Todd, the chasm between them is not as great as all that.
I think you have to make it clear to children, and how a good teacher does it is not something I would want to interfere with, but you have to make it clear to a child that just as if they're sitting down to a meal, it is easier for them if they use a knife and fork on meat rather than a spoon. I mean, theoretically, you could use a spoon, but it's easier to do certain things. The Yorkshire form of English is no better and no worse than the standard form of English, but it is the standard form of English that is the international norm. And I suppose what I would say is the teacher must somehow be able to say to the children, the form that you're using is perfectly acceptable in your homes, it's perfectly acceptable in the familiar circumstances in which you are. But in terms of an education, for better or for worse, the form that you will be examined on in tests and all the rest of it is the standard medium. But it doesn't mean that you have to tell a child that his or her mother tongue, the variety they use in the home, is inadequate. It may not be the variety to use in the educational sphere, but it's not in any way inadequate.
In Britain, far more than in other English-speaking countries, pronunciation comes into the equation. In America, how you pronounce words may fix you geographically. Here, they fix you socially as well. As Laura Wright of Cambridge explains, it's a combination of words and accent.
You can't really, I mean, you can, but nobody ever does, speak Yorkshire dialect with an RP accent. How would it go? Yesterday, I were stuck in traffic jam, and I were stood at corner. I mean, it's artificial, you know. Whereas doing it the other way around, the inverse, you know, using standard English syntax and vocabulary, but with a Yorkshire accent, that's very, very common, because that then begins to correlate with the classes. So as a speech community, what we do is we judge those people who use, say, I don't know, a Yorkshire dialect and a Yorkshire set of vocabulary plus a Yorkshire accent as being working class people from Yorkshire. Whereas those people who speak a standard English syntax with a standard English set of vocabulary but a Yorkshire accent, we would judge as being more middle class. After all, you can get that on the regional news bulletins. And then those people who speak a standard English syntax, a standard English set of vocabulary and an RP accent, they are non-regionally marked. You cannot tell where they come from. They probably come from Kenya, you know, you can't tell. Because they're that tiny percentile of upper middle class and upper class people. I think it's estimated at something like 7 to 8% of the population. They're the ones who own all the money. They're the ones who went to the public schools. And for them, their accent is non-regionally marked. But for all other speakers, we're regionally marked.
Even at the more refined levels of life, a distinctive accent can sometimes be regarded as a kind of misfortune, as Loretta Todd discovered.
When I first started in Leeds as a young lecturer, one of the professors said to me, "Do you not think your accent would be a handicap?" And my attitude was, as long as the students can understand me, how on earth can it be a handicap? I am me. I'm not an RP speaker. I am not from a particular slice of English society. I'm not knocking those people. If that's your accent naturally, good luck to you. But it's not mine. And I mean, I am quintessentially a Northern Ireland person and tremendously happy with that. So why should I not make it overt in my speech?
There are those, like the comedian Arthur Smith, who have learned to capitalise on a distinctive regional speech form.
My brother and I brought up at a very similar time, and he's now the editor of the British Medical Journal and is an establishment figure. And he and I have similar accents, but his wafts a little bit more towards the classical received pronunciation, whereas I, as a performer and comedian, have chosen a broader accent. I mean, we do sound quite similar, but there's no doubt that his is a bit posher than mine. And you know, but he retains it. He was once invited to Buckingham Palace, and his wife was in the toilet and overheard two women speaking about my brother and saying, "Oh yes, that Dr. Richard Smith, he's very nice, but he's rather gore-blimey, isn't he?" If you know, the very first time I went on stage, one of the things about me was my accent. It was quite a strong accent, a strong London accent compared to most people. And so I would naturally choose that, because that already was a sort of statement that came out as a ready-made statement that I was, you know, people make assumptions about some sort of wide boy, East End, you know, bit of a lad, fast-talking, patter merchant, you know, almost the sort of man you see. You rather admire their verbal skills of selling, you know, ripped-off perfume at street corners, that kind of cockney patter type thing. So I chose that because it was something to work with and against. But I don't think I did it consciously. I think I felt that I would be funnier with that accent or more striking.
You must spend quite a lot of your life around people, clearly, who don't have a South London working class accent. And do you find that just the constant exposure to that rubs the edges off your own accent?
I think it does a bit, yeah. I used to say the word dull, which maybe the radio callers wouldn't know what that means. It's doll is probably, and how I've ended up saying it, because in the East End it was like dull. You know, do you know what it is? Here's my Cindy dull. And I found myself being not understood by people. So in the end, I'd said doll at some point. That one I do vaguely remember consciously thinking, right, I'm going to say doll.
Or perhaps they were just puzzled because you had a Cindy doll.
No, it's quite common around my way. We're all very advanced.
One striking feature of English is that we've never had a governing body like the Académie Française in France to try to regulate it. English just blunders along, or to put it more generously, evolves without restraint. Most people see this as a good thing. Loretto Todd.
My feeling is that you cannot pontificate changes. There's no such thing as the language in any case without people. And people will do with the language what they want to do with the language. Change is a sign that a language is alive and kicking. I mean, Latin's not changing very much, but Latin's dead. I don't think we would want the same thing to happen to English.
I understand what you're saying, but at the same time, I mean, I see looking around here that you have compiled and written books on punctuation, dictionary of English usage, and so on, which would seem to imply that you feel that these things are important and worth pushing for.
I think you've got to maintain the standard language. But I'm a great believer in saying every single speaker that I know has a range of Englishes. They have what an old linguist once called the language of slippered ease. When you can be yourself, you don't have to worry about your P's and Q's. That's a style. And then you've got other styles. If you're being formal, you will use a formal style. And what I would like to say is that it's important for us to maintain the formal style for formal interaction. But to try and make people use the one style for every purpose would be the equivalent of trying to make us all dress in grey. What an incredibly dull world it would be.
Indeed. If there is one thing about English to be admired and cherished, it is its almost infinite capacity not to be dull. And that, I'm happy to tell you, is a subject we shall turn to next week.
Is it possible to make an anagram out of my name, Bill Bryson?
Oh, let's have a look. Let's take out the word lobby and see what's left. Only one vowel left. let's try Brolly. You're used to the English Brolly, aren't you? Brolly bins? Where you keep your umbrellas?
Brolly bins. That's incredible. Can you try to see what you can make of mother tongue?
That looks a tough one. Well, we could say, tour the gnome, I suppose.
Tour the gnome.
The gnome tour.
The gnome tour.
Gnome tour.
So, hello. This is Brolly Bins presenting the gnome tour, with a little help there from crossword puzzle expert and inveterate anagramist Roy Dean, from whom more later. If there is one thing about English that we can all be proud of, it is its remarkable affection for wordplay. There exist in English varieties of wordplay almost beyond counting. Puns, palindromes, tongue twisters, cryptograms, crossword puzzles, anagrams, rebuses, clarihues, you name it. Of course, every language in the world indulges in wordplay of some sort, but no speech group has invented more varieties or brought them to a higher level than those who speak English. And in this, I am happy to concede, the British are without peer.
Can I do you now, sir? I've got another follower now, sir. He's a gunner.
Oh, is he? I bet you make him come out of his shell.
Oh, yes, sir. He says I'm a wicked little barrage.
Hello, anybody there?
Oh, hello, I'm Julian, and this is my friend Sandy. Yes. Come for fitting, have you?
Yes, I've been sent up by the producer.
I'm not surprised, Duncan.
Four candles.
Four candles. Here you are. Four candles.
No, four candles.
Well, there you are, four candles.
No, four candles. Handles for forks.
It's not painting. It's passed on. This parrot is no more. It's ceased to be. It has expired. The parrot has gone to meet its maker. This is a late parrot.
Why is it, I've long wondered, that the British are so good at this verbal dexterity? Is there something in the language that encourages a playful character? Or is it something in their character that makes them find playfulness in the language? I put the question to Tony Ogard, author of the Oxford Guide to Wordplay.
This is a very nice thing about the British, I think particularly. They do like to mess about with everything. They can't take things seriously. And they're given the wonderful, serious English language, which is the greatest gift that could be given to any person. And what do? With it? They start turning the words back to front and making palindromes, and they make up anagrams. They'll shuffle the letters around. They'll play with the sounds of the words. They'll play with the meanings of the words. They'll create games that you can play on television, like Call My Bluff, which is a very old dictionary game. Mm-hmm. And they just won't be serious. And that I think that's a wonderful characteristic.
Merryboke, Alan Corrin. As you know, I love doing Call My Bluff. I love it because I get to meet actors. The only problem is I can't shake their hands. I'm very uneasy about shaking their hands because there are so many veterinary series on television today. When you reach out, you think, I know that, it's been up a cow quite recently. And worst of all, you might run into someone who's been dealing with pigs, because a merrybulk is an ulcerous tumour inside the intestine of a pig.
It's one of the great joys, of course, of English. I do this silly programme every day on television, Call My Bluff. Can't do it in Germany.
Really? No, that
you can't do it in France.
Why not?
You can't, because it's not a rich enough language. The academicians in France have cleaned the language out. So you don't have these enormously rich puns. But you don't have the OED, you don't have you don't have a million words. There are infinite possibilities, and so many of them sound funny. And in other languages, words don't really sound funny. I don't know what it is, but I know. I tried reading, because my German's not bad, reading Woodhouse in German. And they translated, remember this very clearly, they translated ice formed on the butler's upper slopes, literally. And it doesn't work, because it sounds like a mountain. Yeah. It doesn't sound like a man. It's simply the overtones of a language that is drawn on so much for so long and has so many words for everything. I mean, it's part of the nature of England to produce synonyms. I mean, I studied Anglo-Saxon, and it was a simple culture. They didn't talk about much. They talked about swords and the sea and death. But they had 90 words for sword and 200 words for the sea and 1,000 words for death.
One of Britain's funniest writers, Alan Corrin. One thing is certain, wordplay in English is as old as English itself. Ray Page, Emeritus Professor of Anglo-Saxon Studies at Cambridge University.
There are a number of riddles in Old English, and some of them have double meanings, and I suppose this double meaning is intended. Here's an example. I'll read it in the Old English first, and it's in verse. Bret lich hongath bewareth theo, freon under sheata. Foran is thurl, with steed and heard, stay the haveth goodna. And I say, esna his argan rail over cane heveth, will that coo the hall mid his hangelen hevda greaten, that he ever lang e'er oft you fylde. Now, a literal translation of this. There's a remarkable thing hanging by a man's thigh under the tunic of the chap. At the front of it, there's a hole. It is stiff and hard, and it has a splendid place. When this man lifts up his own coat, lifts it up over his knee, then it wants to visit that well-known hole with his hanging thing that he often has done before. Now, what is being referred to here? Can you have a guess?
Some kind of tool, perhaps?
Yes, indeed. Yes, you're quite right. Can you be more precise?
I couldn't begin to guess.
Oh, it means a key, of course.
A key.
You thought it meant something else to you? Well, this is the Anglo-Saxon's idea of a joke, and I may say the original of this is in Exeter Cathedral Library.
In order to research his book on wordplay, Tony Ogard hunted through literature looking for references. Not surprisingly, he found them everywhere.
Somebody counted up that Shakespeare used 3,000 puns in his plays. And even at the most serious times, Mercutio in Romeo and Juliet says, "Ask for me tomorrow and I shall be a grave man." And that's just before he's, just as he's dying. So Shakespeare shoved in these puns just at the worst moment, when Macbeth was killing people or Hamlet was throwing his sword in all directions. And ever since, and even before Shakespeare, people were messing about with the language. You get references in Thackeray and Jane Austen to various word games in Pepys's diary, things like that.
What did Pepys write about?
He said that they played Crambo on a journey somewhere, and Crambo is a game where you give somebody a word that rhymes with a word they've got to guess. It's a rather childish game, actually, but you say, "I'm thinking of a word for an animal that rhymes with a log," and then they had to think of dog, you see. It's probably not as basic as that when Pepys was playing it, but that's the sort of game that they played to while away the long hours.
And so it has continued into modern times. Perhaps the greatest addition of our own century to the art of wordplay has been the crossword puzzle. It was invented by an Englishman named Arthur Wynne. Wynne lived in New York, and so the very first crossword, or word cross as Wynne called it, appeared in the New York World newspaper on December 21st, 1913. Wynne's crossword required the solver simply to supply a word that matched a brief definition. And for the most part, in America, the crossword has never really much advanced from that. But in Britain, it became a much more challenging and cerebral enterprise, requiring mastery of cryptic clues, puns, anagrams, embedded words, lexical red herrings, and any number of other verbal traps. It requires a certain fiendish turn of mind to get really good at this, and no one has ever got better than a mild-mannered retired civil servant from Bromley in Kent named Roy Dean. In 1970, he solved a Times crossword in 3 minutes and 45 seconds, a feat that has never been bettered.
Okay, Roy, this is today's Times crossword, number 20,615, for the record. I just wonder if you can guide me through a few of the clues, because I'm absolutely clueless at these.
Well, this is Monday morning, so it should be the easiest one of the week. Crossword editor arranges that to give everyone a good start. Now, if you take one across. One across says, "Dear me, it set back all the players." Well,
it's five letters.
This is a five letters. Now, this is an example of word building. You have to think of "it set back" is obviously T-I, so it's going to end in T-I. What's an expression meaning "dear me"? Well, "tut," for example. So you get the "tut" and the T-I making "tutti," which is all the players in the orchestra. So always in the clue there's a definition, and usually there's another way of arriving at the answer.
I know that there are some publications in America that run cryptic crosswords, and so clearly there are people who do it, but it's nothing like the national passion it is here. Is there something about the British character, you think, that accounts for this love of messing around with words?
Well, it's partly the fact that the words are there to be messed around with. You've got so many words of meanings. I think the word "set" has something like 200 meanings. Every single part of speech is there in the word "set," three letters. And because English is a melting pot, we're taking words from all languages, and you get words that can be pronounced in different ways. The fact is that if you look at an English word, most words will break down into segments or one word inside another. Take the word cabaret, for example. It's bear inside cat.
Of course it is.
So the crossword compiler looking like that would say it shows a nude in indecent act. Act, again, being the anagram for cat.
And the indecent tells you that
it's an anagram. Mm. Or improper. Improper would be better. Nude and improper act seen here.
Is it possible to play with words in the same way in other languages, as far as you know?
I think it would be possible to play with language in the sound of sounds. You have certain sounds in French, for example, where you can pun in French on the sound of words. But I don't really believe any other language is as flexible as English to allow this deconstruction of the words into sections and one word inside another and so on. And you certainly couldn't do it in any of the sort of pictogram languages, Japanese, Chinese, and so on. I doubt if you could do it in Russian. English is absolutely unique. Here's Mrs. Moss.
One of the more curiously challenging forms of wordplay is the palindrome. Words or sentences that read the same backward or forward, as in a man, a plan, a canal, Panama. Roy Dean, not satisfied with mere sentences, devised a palindromic poem of 72 lines, the wordplay equivalent of swimming the English Channel.
Well, here's one stanza of the poem. It has about 12 lines. To establish that it's a port, the first line is the name of the ship. Netta Delia, sailed at 10. Niagara, fall afar again. Riraksak, can snack, cast Kara. A rare medoc, O demerara. Murder noses on red rum. Mum, it poses optimum. To predicate, go get a cider pot. Toll a renegade, bed the general lot to claret. Alas, it is a lateral cot.
Now, you might possibly dismiss this passion for messing about with words as a waste of time and an irrelevance. Not so. At Bletchley Park in Buckinghamshire, during the Second World War, the very skills and lateral mental processes that made the British so adept at crosswords were put to use to break the famous German Enigma code. The success of the Bletchley Park codebreakers is thought to have shortened the war by at least 2 years. Today, Bletchley Park is in the process of being converted into a large-scale museum. It was there I met Tony Sale, its director.
So, Bill, this is the mock-up of an intercept room here, and this is where the important German radio signals were listened to by people crouched over receivers trying to extract the very faint German signals from the ether. So, if we put this receiver on here... Ah, we've got some Morse code straight away. There we are. So this is what the operator would be listening to here, trying to write down this Morse code, which would have been the German signal, which of course they then had to decipher. But of course that signal actually came from an Enigma machine, and here we have a German Enigma machine. And this is the machine which was generating the cipher which we had to try and break. And the total number of combinations on just this, on a three-wheel Enigma, and this is a four-wheel one, but just on a three-wheel Enigma, is 150 million, million, million.
So how on earth did they manage it, and how long did it take them?
Well, the amazing thing is, first of all, they managed it at all, but secondly, the Germans changed the code settings every night at midnight. So all bets off, start again, 150 million, million, million choices. And they reckoned they hadn't done very well in Bletchley Park if they hadn't found the key, amazingly, by 3 o'clock in the morning.
Now, it's always seemed to me that one of the reasons that the British are so good at code breaking is because they have this background and love for wordplay.
Absolutely.
Is that too much of an assumption?
No, that's absolutely right, and I'm sure that was all part of it. I mean, some of the top people here were exceptionally brilliant. Peter Hilton is reputed to be able to have done the Sunday Times crossword in his head without writing it down.
Really?
That's that sort of level of people, and he could hold a string of letters about sort of 20 or 30 long in his mind's eye and slip one set against another and look for correlations in his head. So that was the level of sort of people who were here. But certainly wordplay and that side of it was very, very important indeed.
Now, I understand that crossword puzzles played a role in recruitment here.
Oh, yes, indeed. The recruiters looked for people who were good at chess, at anagrams, and crosswords. And one remarkable story is that one gentleman named Stanley Sedgwick, he was a managing clerk in a small firm in London, and it's happened that the Daily Telegraph ran a competition, a crossword competition, and Stanley was very good at crosswords. And this competition was for anybody who could complete a Daily Telegraph crossword in under 12 minutes. So Stanley went in for this competition, and he put the result in, or had the result authorised, and he was amazed to find, landing on his doormat about a week or so later, a summons to go to somebody in the Foreign Office for an interview. And he went, and that's how he came to Bletchley Park. And he worked in MacVitie's section, which was breaking the German Met codes, and he worked there the whole of the war.
English is a democratic language, and toying inventively with words is not limited to the more rarefied strata of the intellectual world. Indeed, one of the most delightful and enduring forms of wordplay emerged rather lower down the social scale. I refer to Cockney rhyming slang, parodied here by Ronnie Barker.
As he staggered along, he saw, there on the pavement, a small brown Richard III. And he stared at it, lying there at his plates of meat. And he picked it up. And he put it on top of the wall where no one could step on it. And a rich 4x2-ish merchant who witnessed the deed put his hand into his skyrocket and took out a Lady Godiva and handed it to the man, saying, "I saw you pick up that Richard III. And that was a kindly act. Pray take this Lady Godiva for your froth and bubble." And the man took it and went on his way rejoicing. And the small brown Richard III flew back to its nest.
Lexicographer Jonathan Green has devoted years to investigating slang of all types for a soon-to-be-published dictionary. How long has rhyming slang been with us?
It would appear to come on stream around the middle of the 19th century. It's sort of East End market tradesman language that emerged during that period, and it's gone on ever since.
Right, and were they using it for their own amusement or as a kind of code?
I think as a kind of code. You see, there are other slangs at that period that have, on the whole, vanished, and backslang is one of them, and a refinement of that butcher's backslang.
Which is?
In which you say bemal instead of lamb. Well, I've actually heard it. I mean, once somebody used the word, I think, something like feeb instead of beef, and I was an absolute heaven for the whole day. I wanted to say this man, thank you. But I think on the whole it's died, nonetheless. It was a rather old man.
How many different rhyming slang expressions did you come up with for your book?
I've got around 1,700, and I doubt for a second that that is comprehensive, because they come and go, but that's the ones I've picked up.
What are some of the more recent ones, then?
There's Ayrton, as in Ayrton Senna, the racing driver. Ayrton Senna means a tenner, means a £10 note. We've got barley here, which is actually short for oats and barley. Oats and barley, it's a double one, this, because oats and barley rhymes with Charlie. Charlie means cocaine. So a line of barley is a line of cocaine. Bradleys, which comes from Brad Pitt, which rhymes with tit. So a nice pair of Bradleys. Howard's Way, which Howard it is, I wouldn't know. But Howard's, I presume it came from the Ian Forster book. But Howard's Way means gay. He's a bit of a Howard. And on it goes. I mean, there's a number of them. Leo Sayer means an all-day drinking session, and apparently Leo Sayer rhymes with all-dayer. So you're off for a quick Leo, or a lengthy Leo, it would probably be.
Right. Jonathan gave us many more examples, most of them, alas, unbroadcastable. A striking feature of English literature is the extent to which its leading writers have used humour, from Chaucer to Dickens and beyond. Nearly all the greatest names in the literary firmament have been distinguished in some measure by a mastery of wit and wordplay. There cannot be another country where the ability to make people laugh is quite so venerated. I put the matter to Alan Corrin.
One of the things that most impressed me when I first came to Britain was the humour. And there seemed to be this kind of humour that was based on wordplay that I had never really encountered in the same way in the States when I was growing up. Even movies like the Carry On films had, most of the humour, a very large part of it was based on puns and double entendres.
Well, it was innuendo, and that's why English is so wonderfully smutty. Things in English somehow, and I've never been able to understand why, if they are put in a context where a nudge is expected, they will become funny, which is to say you can call a penis anything. You can say, oh, he's a man, he had an enormous Norman. Oh, my God, have you seen the size of that Bernard? Or she had an amazing pair of, what shall we call them, mop dinners. And you think, why is it funny? But it actually is. And it sort of doesn't work in American. American doesn't have innuendo in quite the same way. A lot of that is to do with the tradition of demotic music hall comedy. Shakespeare is shot through with it. You know, thou horse unzed, thou unnecessary letter, or, you know, thou Jacob. The porter speech is a Max Miller routine. Launcelot Gobbo, Falstaff, Nim, Bardolph, all these people are straight situation comedy, Carry On, Knockabout.
Now, what about the other strand of English humour that struck me when I first came here, and that's this love of nonsense? I mean, things like Jabberwocky, and that, you know, makes absolutely no sense, but is still amusing.
That's just about the language being funny.
Yeah.
But it just... And the language being so funny that you can actually invent it and it sounds like English. You can come up with chortle because you want something that just happens to fit, the grin, chuckle, all the rest. You make it up, it passes into the language. Brillig and slithy. English words are components of sounds which are themselves potentially very funny. And though we've already said that it's the richest language in the world, still not rich enough for the fantasists. They still carry on making up stuff. They still come up with Brillig and Jabberwocky.
"'Twas Brillig, and the slithy toves did gyre and gimble in the wabe. All mimsy were the borogoves, and the mome raths outgrabe."
It's very hard to think of a figure in British English literature that isn't also funny. I mean, it seems
it's totally true, absolutely true, all the way through from the novels. I mean, starting with Chaucer and going through, if you think of the great heroes of Ing Lit, the writers who are Richardson, Thackeray, Sterne, amazing, Tristram Shandy, astonishing at that time to a huge comic novel, and then on through... you know, through that 19th century, which is just comedy, while the Russians are producing Lermontov and Dostoevsky and Tolstoy, and the French are producing Balzac, you know, and Flaubert. What we're producing is Thomas Love Peacock, Jane Austen, Dickens, Thackeray. It's quite astonishing. It is a very rich comic tradition that really pours through 800 years of continuous comedy.
What is it? I mean, is there something in the British character that encourages that kind of writing?
I know that the British, not just the English, the British response to disorder is to survive it by laughing at it. It's Arthur Moe Kaiser. I mean, Punch's great strengths were the Depression, the First World War, the Second World War. Its sales were enormous. People turned to humour. It is something to do with a stiff upper lip and a lower lip trembling with laughter simultaneously.
There is another way to be funny in English, unwittingly. Here's Julie Walters reading the instructions on the back of an Italian food packet.
"Bring in cannelloni as they are, a stuffing macked with beef, eggs, papa or spices, all well amalgamated and juicy. Besmear a backing pan and after dispose the cannelloni lightly distanced between them in an only couch."
English, as we all know, has become a global language, the most successful the world has ever known, spoken as a mother tongue by more than 350 million people, and by many more as a second tongue. But for that, we need another program. Or, as Roy Dean might say, a meager thorn romp.